please rise? The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Werke, Judge Bentley, the Honorable Renee Werke presiding.
Good morning. Go ahead and take a seat. Yes, you've all noticed the odd configuration. Judge John Smith is also assigned to this case panel. He is unable to be here today, so he will be listening to the arguments, and then he will give me some feedback. He will be conferring, of course, with the panel after we take the cases as submitted. With that in mind, both of you have been here before. You each have 15 minutes to state your case. Mr. Flugel, if you need to have the microphone up or down, there's a button there. Please feel free to use that. 5 minutes will be reserved for rebuttal if you choose to do that. I will ask our marshal, Miranda Johnson, to please call the first case for consideration.
Calling case number A240797, Richard Nichols versus North Memorial Healthcare.
Good morning. May it please the court, my name is Will Flegel, and I'm here on behalf of the appellants, the Nichols. This is a medical malpractice case in which the trainee doctor punctured Mr. Nichols' heart during a procedure to insert a drainage tube into his chest. The trial court granted JMOL, or a directed verdict, at the conclusion of the plaintiff's case in chief. We contend that that was an error which requires reversal for two principal reasons. First of all, a directed verdict is not proper if the plaintiff has presented a prima facie case. And secondly, there are three principal pieces of evidence that established a prima facie case in this matter, particularly as relates to the subject matter of causation, which was the focus of the trial court's ruling. First of all, the standard of care established that supervision by the supervising doctor must be, quote, hands-on, close quote. He must be present to supervise, at page 17 of Dr. Adams' transcript. Secondly, after a heart alarm sounds, the procedure must stop and should not continue because
I'm curious about this heart alarm sound, especially after reading your supplemental authority that was submitted. Part of the failure, according to the trial judge, as far as your submissions, is that there was nothing stated in terms of what the attending physician could have done. What could he have done? And my curiosity, is this an alarm that is like a fire alarm that everybody takes notice, or is it just a beep? And tell me where in your presentation and your affidavit you countered that by saying what could this attending physician have done even if he had been there?
Okay. A couple of things. I don't want to get into any extra record stuff, but if you imagine your TV series with the beep, beep, beep of a heart monitor, it's an alarm that's intended to get the attention. It's a verbal signal, and according to Dr. Adams' testimony, that means things should stop.
But isn't it already then too late?
No, ma'am. Okay. Specifically, the harm is not done until the heart itself is punctured. In his testimony, Dr. Adams indicated that if the alarm goes, it's either due to a wire or a needle touching the wall of the heart. It interrupts the electric rhythm that keeps the heart moving. And so when that interruption occurs, that signals the device to sound.
The puncture have already happened?
Could it or
yeah.
did it?
Could it?
According to Dr. Adams, it did not. From a hypothetical perspective, I suppose a possibility exists that it was one move, but the alarm continued to sound for some period of time. So one would argue that it's more consistent with the view that Dr. Adams had, that the damage was not yet done. What I want to emphasize to the court this morning is what, in response, Judge Werke, to your second part of your question, what was in the record that would have substantiated that the supervisor could have done anything. And I think for purposes of analysis, the analogy that occurs to me is the student pilot who suddenly has to land the plane without their instructor's assistance. The instructor is there to provide guidance. You're in the wrong place, you're in the right place. In my brief, I analogized it to cutting off the wrong leg. the supervisor would be in a position to stop the procedure from, so that the, they weren't drilling in the wrong place. But secondly, in light of the alarm that you raised as an issue, Judge Werke, because there was evidence in the record, prima facie evidence, that the damage had not yet been done, when the alarm sounded and the student continued forward with the process, a supervisor could have said, you've got to stop. The standard of care is to stop. So you don't continue forward and puncture the heart. These are reasonable and permissive inferences, and in light of that, a prima facie case was established.
I have a follow-up question about the standard of care of supervision.
Yes.
Because I thought that it was a Dr. Adams had also acknowledged that depending on the experience of the student and the comfort level of the supervisor, that it may be within the standard of care that a supervisor not be standing next to the student doing a procedure like this. So could you address that point?
Certainly. I appreciate your bringing that up. What we contended in our brief is that that establishes merely impeachment and that Dr. Adams' fundamental opinion about the standard of care was neither withdrawn nor excluded, so it's still of record. And we're not dealing with affidavits here as we would in a 145-682 situation. This was trial testimony. So with respect to the testimony in the record, in this case, we know that the doctor, the student had done the procedure once under the observation of the supervisor, but the opinion of Dr. Adams is that you have to be physically present in the room until you're convinced that the person has developed the proper technique and tactile approach. You have to physically locate where the heart is and where the chest cavity, where the fluid is building up within the lung is, and you do that by counting the ribs according to the testimony. So the reason that this is characterized as a never event is that it should never occur. In Dr. Adams' testimony, when he studied the literature, he indicated that in the past 30 years, it's only been reported to have occurred 7 times, even though this is a very, very common procedure. So we submit that an inference that could have been drawn by the jurors is that because of the rarity of this kind of event, had the supervisor been there, they could readily have said you're in the wrong place or...
Didn't Dr. Adams also indicate that Davis was compliant in the standard of care, that he didn't have to be in the room when this was going on?
He testified that he did have to be in the room at page 17, lines 20 through 23 of the transcript. In cross-examination, as Judge Bentley points out, they confronted him with, but did you know this? Did you consider that? And so forth. I believe these issues would go to weight rather than to the jury's capacity to consider the information. In other words, it would be for them to weigh. But do you have another follow-up, Judge?
No, I need to check the record on that. Thank you.
Okay. What I'm saying is, and I want to address this as directly as I can, there are positions in cross-examination, if you want to compare what I just cited you to page 70 of the transcript, there you'll find the cross-examination about, did you know this, did you consider that? But we're dealing with a pure evidentiary issue here. If the standard of review that applies in this context is whether there's legally sufficient evidence in the record upon which reasonable minds could make a determination in plaintiff's favor, and under the Lamb versus Jordan case, we're not to have as judges the court weighing the evidence and resolving credibility. That issue and resolving any conflict within the evidence is for the jury to decide, and so the matter would not be properly resolved through summary judgment or directed verdict.
So To me, there seems to be two kind of separate issues here. One is the standard of care with respect to whether or not he had to be in the room.
Right.
And that, I think, if and again, I take your point about the record, but let's say that the standard of care says that he didn't have to be in the room. That would resolve, I mean, that would be the end of your argument, right? Because it doesn't then matter what happens with the never event if he didn't have to be in the room. Is that right?
I'm going to disagree with you
okay.
there. With regard to the issue of whether he has to be in the room, I believe taking the evidence in the light favorable to the party resisting this motion, it would be that there was evidence that he had to be in the room, then there comes to be a sliding scale of judgment. Am I certain that you have enough experience to cover this deposition for me? Do I actually have to watch you do it before I send you out to do that? That would be a judgment by the supervisor. The ultimate opinion, however, of Dr. Adams was that in these circumstances, the Dr. Davis had to be in the room.
Okay, so I guess I take that point. So just for the sake of argument, I'm not saying this is what I'm thinking,
of
but
course.
Just for the sake of argument, if I don't agree with that, that there was not a standard care that he had to be in the room regardless of the never event, then that at least, that is a separate question, right? Or that's, and maybe you'd, maybe that's not. I guess I'm trying to figure out where to direct our attention here. Is it on the standard of care about whether he is in the room, or is it to the fact that the causation issue, which is whether or not had he said stop, let's say he was in the room and said stop, that actually would have made a material difference to a point of at least enough certainty that you could give it to the jury that as a point of causation, right? So I'm looking at those two points, and maybe, you know, I'm curious if you, it sounds like you disagree at least on the first one, that one's not really the one that we should be paying attention to. We should be paying attention to the second issue.
The verdict was directed because of the absence of causation evidence, which I think focuses on your second inquiry mm-hmm. more. I'm willing to argue with anybody
yeah.
about both, but as to what I think the focus is here in terms of going through the court's approach, the trial court's approach, it was what difference would it make? And I think the seductive parts of defense argument in that was, well, look, the damage was already done because obviously the heart was punctured, the monitor went off, the alarm went off. Then Dr. Adams' testimony says, no, you're just touching the heart at the point that the monitor goes off. You haven't yet punctured the heart. That's why if someone was there, they would say, the alarm is on, stop. So we think we prevail on the monitor theory. But going back to, was he in the wrong place? Because we should have survived a directed verdict on either the monitor going off theory or on the puncture of the heart theory.
What about the fact that Adams didn't say anything about what caused the monitor to go off in the first place? I mean, is that something vital?
Yeah, he does posit two possibilities, and there's a hypothetical third, and I think we were taken to task because we weren't able to say, was it the wire that did this? Was it the needle that did this? Was it the trocar? What part exactly, by analogy, how deep was the knife when it stabbed the victim's heart? You didn't show whether it was a quarter of an inch or half an inch. All you did was prove that it went into his heart. And I don't think that's respectfully our obligation in a causation case. The reason I sent the supplemental authority is that it basically stands for the proposition that in medical malpractice, it's no different than any other tort litigation. You simply have to show that it's a substantial contributing factor. And in this circumstance, I believe that either not being there to say, stop, you're in the wrong place, or not being there to say, you need to stop. You've made contact with the heart. We know that because the heart alarm is sounding, would be something that a jury could rationally infer, yeah, by George, that is the cause that sets these chain of unfortunate events in motion where there's a injury to the heart and a stroke and consequent issues. So Unless there are other questions, I appreciate your questions because this probably all occurred within a matter of seconds, but it's obviously very important to both parties. And I think most importantly, because of the standard of review that applies here, because there was an issue of fact upon which a rational jury could have determined the matter in favor of the plaintiff, that respectfully it was improper to grant directed verdict and that the matter should be reversed and remanded for trial.
Thank you.
Good morning, and may it please the court. Pat O'Neill from Larson King on behalf of respondent North Memorial Healthcare. The question we're here to answer today is whether Richard Nichols presented sufficient evidence supported by expert testimony on the issue of causation to allow his claim to be heard by the jury. The district court correctly determined that Nichols' expert, Dr. Warren Adams, failed to offer sufficient testimony to provide a reasonable basis for the jury to find that Dr. Davis was negligent. The district court should be affirmed for two key reasons. Dr. Adams failed to offer an opinion as to, one, the specific actions or inactions Dr. Davis would have observed had he been present during the procedure, and two, the specific actions Dr. Davis could have taken to prevent Nichols' injury had he been physically present. Essentially, Dr. Adams failed to offer any expert testimony regarding how Dr. Davis could have prevented the injury, nor why his absence from the room was a substantial factor in that injury. Minnesota law, quote, mandates.
Okay, but Adams did say that when the signal goes off, what is a VTAC? Is that how it's pronounced?
Yeah, it's a ventricular tachycardia alarm.
When this goes off, he did say that the doctor would then say, oops, my words, not his, I've went too far, and back off.
The issue with that, and I think that it was kind of highlighted by some of the remarks made by counsel today, is that there's no information in the record regarding the timing of the VTAC, nor what set it off. We have two possibilities of what set it off, the needle or the guide wire. So the needle, the instrument we're talking about here is a pigtail catheter. It has four components. The first is a needle that punctures the skin and gets you to where you need to be to relieve the free air. The second is a wire that kind of feeds the catheter in. One of those two, according to the expert, one of those two irritated the heart. We don't know which one, we don't know when it happened, and we don't know what Dr. Davis could have done in response to the alarm. We don't know the matter of seconds or minutes the alarm was going off, and we don't know, again, the sequence, whether it was the first implement or the second implement that irritated the heart at which Dr. Davis could have intervened.
Does it make a difference, or maybe my better way to ask it is, why does it matter which it was?
I think the sequence matters a lot. If the first implement hit punctured the heart, then the damage is done when the alarm goes off. If it's the second implement, maybe Dr. Davis could have done something. We don't know, and the jury wasn't, didn't have a reasonable basis to determine the underlying cause of negligence, let alone what Dr. Davis could have done to prevent it, and that is why a directed verdict was proper.
As I understood, Mr. Flugel had mentioned that Dr. Adams testified that the heart hadn't been punctured at the time the alarm went off. Is that a fact issue in the record, or?
Bear with me one moment, Your Honor. Dr. Adams testified generally about what a VTAC is. He didn't testify how the VTAC was set off in this case with specificity. He said, quote, it's a signal to the physician that maybe they've gone too far. They are maybe irritating the heart muscle, so stop. Irritating the heart muscle, puncturing the heart muscle, again, Dr. Adams wasn't clear as to whether or not irritation means puncture or irritation means something less than that. But again, we're left with an equivocal statement of maybe they've gone too far at the time the alarm goes off, not what should Dr. Davis do when the alarm goes off. That's what's absent from the record, and that's why directed verdict was proper. Um, kind of returning to the three arguments raised now on appeal. This is largely an effort to recast Dr. Adams' testimony and supplement it where it was found deficient by the district court. There's kind of three main arguments on that. The significance of the term of art, a never event. The right spot argument and the VTAC alarm. I think we've discussed the VTAC alarm, so kind of focusing on the never event question. The never event, plaintiff argues now that the never event is a term of art akin to a wrong site surgery or a, you know, operating on the wrong leg or leaving a sponge in a body. This is a far cry from a wrong site surgery. This is a procedural error that occurred during a medical procedure with a specific device. There are multiple components, and expert testimony was clearly necessary to allow the jury to understand where Dr. Morris went wrong, and more importantly, the real issue here, where Dr. Davis could have intervened to prevent Dr. Morris from going wrong. We were left with neither, and that, again, is why directed verdict was proper. Simply calling it a never event doesn't relieve Nichols of his burden of proof, or show the jury how or why Dr. Davis was negligent. Turning now to the bright spot question, Dr. Adams never opined that Dr. Morris inserted the needle in the right spot, nor that Dr. Davis could have identified an alternate placement, angle, or anything like that to prevent the heart from being irritated. Instead, Dr. Adams opined that, quote, the catheter should have entered the chest where it did, but terminated in a different area, end quote. That means that Dr. Davis, had he been present observing it, would not have changed where it went. There had to be something in the interim that Dr. Davis would have been aware of and could have intervened. And again, there's no record on the, or there's no evidence in the record on the timing of the puncture of the heart, nor the VTAC alarm.
I mean, that seems like where this comes down to is what, at that moment that it touched the heart, whether or not when that alarm goes off, let's say it was only seconds, that had Dr. Davis been there, he would have said stop, and that could have prevented the puncture going, right? So it's that, it seems like this is coming down to just that moment. So why is it that, and I don't know if you can point whether it's into the record. I know we've been dancing around this a bit, but you know, how do we know for purposes of directed verdict as opposed to letting a jury decide whether in that moment, had he said stop, that it wouldn't have done the, it would have prevented the damage. So, because, you know, we're talking here as a matter of law, that there's no way the jury could find it. So where is the gap in the evidence, assuming that they believed everything Dr. Adams said?
Dr. Adams didn't specify when Dr. Davis should have said stop. He didn't have a timeline. He didn't have a specific time or event that would have forced Dr. Davis to say stop or presented any evidence about what Dr. Davis would have observed had he been present in order to be in a position to say stop. All we have in
he hears the alarm.
Right, but we don't know when the alarm went off, nor do we know if the alarm went off when the damage was already done. The district court was very clear that the only evidence in the record was that the harm was done at the time the alarm went off. There's no evidence to the contrary, and I don't believe that Dr. Adams issued a admissible opinion as to the timing anywhere else in the record. The closest, or I'd like to briefly touch on the standard of care as it was discussed by counsel.
I know as far as the standard of care, as far as cross-examination, Adams said it's up to, there's leeway as far as whether the doctor is going to be standing next to the person performing the procedure, so there's a certain amount of give and take on how that happens.
Yes, Dr. Adams' opinion was based on specific medical regulations about supervision of fellows and other trainee physicians, and his testimony was that whether or not to allow a physician to act independently requires the supervising attending to observe them, treating other patients, ask them about their experience with the procedure, ask them about their comfort level with performing the procedure before allowing them to do anything independently. Here we have Dr. Morris, a board certified general physician or general surgeon who had been credentialed on her own in a hospital for years prior to her critical care fellowship. She's selected into this critical care fellowship. She had been there for weeks. Dr. Davis personally observed her place a pigtail catheter on another patient and also observed her working in all manner of ways. He also asked her if she was comfortable, or asked her if she had experience with the pigtail procedure, and also confirmed she was comfortable performing the procedure. Dr. Adams testified that if Dr. Davis did all those things, he met the standard of care. The evidentiary, his opinion has to be based on evidence. The only evidence in the record is that Dr. Davis met the standard of care articulated by Dr. Adams. He personally observed her perform the procedure a previous time, the very same procedure she was asked to perform, and confirmed she was comfortable with it. Lastly, I'd just like to touch on the supplemental authority raised by counsel yesterday. That's the Rigwall decision. The Rigwall decision involved the expert review statute, not directed verdict. But there are...
That's why when I asked my question, I talked about affidavit versus testimony, but yes.
But there are, you know, three distinct times where a plaintiff needs to show that the expert can, that their expert can support a prima facie claim for medical malpractice. The first is at the time the complaint is sworn out, the expert has to verify that facts exist to support this claim. 120 days after discovery, the expert has to set forth the substance and summarize the basis of their opinions to withstand summary judgment. At trial, the expert has to convey those opinions to the jury based on the facts produced at trial to show the court that there is a reasonable basis for the jury to find in their favor. The prima facie case elements are the same at all three stages, but it has to get more specific at each stage, eventually at trial, identifying the how and why of the negligence. If the how and why of the negligence is never set forth, dismissal is required at any one of those stages. If the expert won't sign off on the affidavit of expert review, the complaint can't go out. If the expert affidavit doesn't set forth the how and why of the negligence in a summary fashion, the case has to be dismissed at summary judgment. If the expert doesn't set out the how and why with specificity at trial in front of the jury based on the evidence admissible, directed verdict is required. So, in short, the district court properly determined that Nichols failed to produce expert testimony as to how Dr. Davis was negligent by not personally supervising the procedure or why his absence was a substantial contributing factor to the injury. If there are no further questions, I'll yield the rest of my time.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I was going to cover three points. First of all, to address the timeline issue. Second, the alarm and when harm occurred, and finally, cause. But do you have any questions before I begin? Because those are more important than anything I might say.
I'll let you
all right.
go
I'll
your
get
direction.
You, I'll get you started here. First of all, in terms of the absence of a timeline for what Dr. Davis might have done, Dr. Davis was not in the room. And it seems a little odd that we're being faulted for not being able to say specifically how much time he had or didn't have when he's not at all in the room, and that's the genesis of the issue. So I don't think a fair criticism is to comment about the timeline. What I want to next turn to is the alarm itself, and I want to give a citation to the record, if I may. This is where Dr. Adams is talking about that there is not an injury or damage, just that the wall is hit. And that's at page 26, line 25 through page 27, line 4. That's his indication that the alarm goes off when you're just hitting the wall. So I don't think we have, it's all over simply because the alarm goes off. At least we created a fact issue on that, which would obviate directed verdict.
So the issue with that I think I'm struggling with or trying to understand with the alarm is that I understand the point that when you hit the wall, the alarm goes off. But what we don't know, or I guess what I'd like to hear about where in the record we could find that, you know, that the puncture doesn't happen at that moment. I mean, either the alarm goes off here or the alarm goes off as you go through, but which one of those is, and that seems to me to be the question. So how do we know in this record it was the, you know, hit the wall and then there was an opportunity to stop versus the fact that the harm had been done?
I'm going to ask a question in response. Why does that matter?
Well, I guess that at least the way that I understand the argument is that if it goes straight through, there's no time to say stop. The damage has been done, so there, you can't say that Dr. Davis had caused
that. In which case, if you resolve those facts in that manner against us, as a jury might, then we lose that second theory, and all we've got is that he's allowed to be in the wrong place to begin with, the first theory. So ultimately, directed verdict was improper. It's almost an either-or circumstance there, that either he was in the wrong place to begin with and a supervisor would have said, don't go there, or somehow if the supervisor missed that and then continuing to proceed in the presence of the alarm would be an error. The reason I asked the question is that there are fact issues on all of these points, and that obviates a directed verdict. You could resolve the issue that way as a juror, but then you'd be on the jury and not acting as a judge would in a directed verdict motion. The last thing I want to leave you with is Dr. Adams' comment about the cause here and the importance of Dr. Davis being in the room. That's at page 17, lines 18 through 23, where he says that if Dr. Davis had been present in the room, Mr. Nichols' injury, quote, would have never happened. That, I think, relieves doubt or at least creates a fact question on the role of the supervisor and his importance in being in the room for this procedure. Thank you both for your questions this morning.
Thank you to both counsel for appearing today in support of your matters. The matters were well briefed. The arguments, of course, were excellent, and the matter is deemed submitted. Thank you.